I know he's at first. You've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the cunts, the dogs, the filth, the shit. Here is someone who stood up.
Well, like I was saying, this is a special broadcast we have on. As many of you know, I have never brought on any form of economist or anybody speaking about money onto my show ever before. The reason why is because I myself have the great pleasure of being able to be under the tutelage of two of the Austrian economists out there, Murray Rothbard and Hans Hoppe, two of the guys who formed the Mises Institute, Austrian economics, big proponents of them here. Rothbard was even the founder of the Libertarian Party in the U.S. I was able to be students under both of them for 2 years at UNLV. And during that time, I had a lot of questions, I had a lot of problems. In fact, I saw the Austrian economic system as being part of the dialectic. In fact, if you really analyze Austrian economics and Keynesian economics, it's the same bowl of crap with a different ribbon on it presented to you in a different way. It's all part of the dialectic. So I, for the last 20 years, I've really been trying to find somebody with some idea about an economics model that I could sink my teeth into and not find faults with. It's taken me 20 years. I finally found that individual. I'm surprised I hadn't found him beforehand. But we have with our guest tonight, Mike Montaigne, the founder and original architect of Mathematically Perfected Economy. Welcome to UF Tredemy, Mike.
Good evening, Dave, Randy. Pleased to be on your show. I was listening there, I was realizing that you were introducing me as a virtual economist, which I am not.
No, you are not an economist. That is, you're a mathematician.
That's right, and a software engineer, who actually, I was actually thrown into economics as a teenager. It was beneath my regular curriculum, and my original introduction was an observation that the textbook that we were to work from and the entire science so-called of economy is entirely bereft of formal proof or theorem. It's nothing but a pseudoscience. So I'm definitely not an economist, at least in that sense, although I might be considered an economist in the sense of developing the first actual proofs of theorems which comprise an actual economy, that is an eradication of redundant expense and a minimization of the system to really no more than a simple accounting system.
Well, you know, that was the one thing that I really found interesting about your entire economic model that you presented. I mean, to be honest with you, it took me several hours to break it down to the most common denominators because I wasn't able to get out of the trap of the Austrian Keynesian economic systems. And I was constantly stuck within those paradigms that they created themselves, you know, usury, this, that. Your system breaks down to two very simple words, no usury.
one other thing. It is actually, in the end, mathematically perfected economy is no more than an eradication of interest and an obligatory schedule of payment that is in which in restoring the right of the people to issue their own promissory obligations free of exploitation, we eradicate interest and we impose this obligatory schedule of payment, which pays and retires principal at the rate of consumption or depreciation of the related property. So in relation to a $100,000 home, for instance, with a 100-year lifespan, overall we would pay $1,000 a year for that home. That is, as the payment of principal is retired from circulation, the mere obligatory schedule of payment, therefore, maintains a circulation which is always equal to the remaining value of not only each, but the entire sum of related property without any regulation whatsoever.
Let's start with this then. Basically, you know, there's a lot more to this story than your than these mathematically proven economic models that you have. So let's start there. How did you come upon this conception that our entire economic system is flawed, our the models that we use are flawed, and that even the very ideas we have are incorrect?
Yeah. Background sound is pretty loud, Randy, so I'm getting a lot of pollution from that, too. The idea... as many mathematic ideas came to me in those days. I had a very advanced education in mathematics as a young child, college algebra in the second grade. And in high school, I was in an economics class, and the first thing I used to do with a textbook would be to open the book and thumb it through from beginning to end at least once. Often with more challenging material, I would do this several times and, you know, maybe review the first half of the book several times and then go to the beginning and before I even, you know, proceeded with any of the lessons, just to get my brain very clearly around where whatever it was began, how it was constructed, where it was going. Being as I was placed in this economics class, which was beneath my curriculum, I took the textbook, which was as large as any mathematics or geometry textbook I'd ever had, and I was very surprised when I went through it that it was entirely bereft of formal proof and theorem. There wasn't one proof or theorem in the entire book. And being as all this material related to the fundamentals of the lie of economy, I found that very disturbing. Of course, in you know, watching what people in the news had to say, it was obvious that no accountable answers were ever given in regard to economy. And I had, you know, I was a great skeptic that really anybody knew what they were doing in it anyway. But in any case, you know, it was about 2 weeks into this economics course, in a school where the teachers, the faculty, you know, was apprised that, for instance, in my math class, I was doing things like proving the Pythagorean theorem for a teacher off the top of my head. You know, regularly I would prove all the theorems of geometry as we proceeded through the course and all. And so I was respected by the faculty, and I was more than miffed about this economics course. Not at that particular course, but the topic. We got to a point about 2 weeks in the course where the teacher introduced the definitions for inflation and deflation, and these would be the traditional definitions, which we've actually deviated substantially from since this day. And so he gave the definitions of what I call circulatory inflation and deflation as increases or decreases in circulation or the volume of money in circulation per goods and services, what was what he related it to. And he no sooner gave these definitions, which were obvious and simple, then asserted on top of that that circulatory inflation caused price inflation. He just said so, as they just say so today. And this I found very disturbing. There, practically everything that was taught was a matter of, instead of understanding it, you merely memorized it, because a lot of things such as this don't make sense. That is, this purported connection between circulatory inflation and price inflation. In fact, we have, you know, the Ron Paul camp today claiming circulatory inflation merely on account of what money is coming into circulation. And I'm going to explain some of these relationships a little bit later, hopefully. And they say that this, they just say that this causes price inflation. And the reason that I distinguish the two with different terms, circulatory inflation and price inflation respectively, in regard to what's lumped under one term, inflation typically, is that they're distinct things without any established connection at all. And in response to these this assertion, I raised my hand in this class and off the top of my head disproved this purported connection pretty much like this. I said to my teacher, his name was Mr. Otto, I said, "Mr. Otto, I just can't accept how that is possibly true." In other words, he had said that circulatory inflation, an increase in circulation per goods and services, caused price inflation. So I said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Otto, I just can't imagine how that could possibly be so." I said, "First of all, you've taught us that all money comes into circulation as a debt subject to interest, and that all of the debts are collateralized. Therefore, first of all, how is it even possible to suffer circulatory inflation? After all, if the debts are collateralized, we can't borrow more into circulation than goods and services exist." And he stood there silent, turning redder and redder for a while. And next thing you know, he says, "By God, I think you're right." I said, "Furthermore, if all of the money comes into circulation as a debt subject to interest, even if we did suffer this circulatory inflation, which we've just shown is mathematically impossible to suffer if debts are collateralized, then how yet, even if we did suffer that somehow," which we haven't established that there is a way how yet could this possibly be a cause of price inflation? Because if the money comes into circulation as a debt subject to interest, this comprises an implicit obligation to pay principal and interest out of circulation, which at any time is at most comprised of some remaining principal. Therefore, out of a smaller sum of some remaining principal, we are nonetheless obligated to pay all of the further principal and all of the interest on any current sum of debt. Thus, we are obliged to maintain a vital circulation all the while that we can continue to service these debts. And being as the money comes into circulation as a debt subject to interest, therefore we can only borrow it back into circulation to reflate the circulation of what interest and principal we're paying out of a circulation comprised of only some remaining principal. So, what principal we reborrow as new debt equal to the old establishes a new sum of debt, equal to the old, making it mathematically impossible to pay down the sum of debt, and what interest we borrow back into circulation to maintain a vital circulation, then, being as that counted none against the former sum of debt, comprised the new debt equal to so much as periodic interest on what then would be an ever greater sum of debt, until eventually, at even an inherently escalating rate of ever greater sums of periodic interest on an ever greater sum of debt, ultimately we reach a terminal sum of debt which inevitably exceeds our capacity to service it. And so we would fail because in exceeding our creditworthiness, we would our ability to borrow further would be invalidated by the fact that we couldn't service any further debt. Therefore, we could no longer maintain a vital circulation, and the circulation would almost immediately deflate as we pay against this terminal sum of debt, you know, the final payments of interest and principal that we can under such a system. Meanwhile, all the while on this road to terminal failure, evermore the circulation would be dedicated to servicing the ever greater sum of debt, leaving ever less to sustain the industry and the rising prices that you claim are a consequence of inflation, which we can't even establish a way it can exist. So the only systemic cause of rising prices then is interest, because it multiplies the sum of artificial indebtedness in proportion to our remaining capacity to service debt. And he stood there for quite a while longer, just silent, turning ever redder yet. And finally he said, "By God, I think you're right again." And that was the beginning of it. I went home from school, and I was 16, and I realized I had a very important idea. But then I didn't think I would be the only one in the world to have this idea, because, you know, these facts are obvious. You see, interest is terminal. And what we really need to understand is, you know, people say, well, who would loan us money if it weren't subject to interest? Well, you're not borrowing money at all. On the contrary, you're merely presuming that you have to borrow your own promissory notes or evidence of our promissory obligations to each other, whereas the banking system, the central banking system, merely publishes the evidence of our debts to each other. And we think, wrongly, of course, that we have to borrow that into circulation. The bank gives up nothing to establish either lawful consideration, and there's no justification whatsoever for interest. And if we charge interest to each other, of course, it would cancel out. There would be no ultimate reason or benefit from it at all. So the case exists then, it argues, for a restoration of the right of everyone, of the individual, to issue their promissory obligations free of extrinsic adulteration, manipulation, exploitation, or denial of the very opportunity to make good on them. And so mathematically perfected economy is an eradication of this cause of terminal failure and two other categoric faults that I gave. And those are resolved by, the integral combination of an eradication of interest and an obligatory schedule of payment.
Sorry about that, Mike. I've got to unmute my mic, and that takes a moment for it to actually unmute itself. But I do have a question for you from someone in the chat room. They ask, why do we even need an economic model? Wouldn't it be better to let the government only establish value, as in the Constitution, than allow supply and demand to dictate its own course?
Well, there's two questions there. The answer is no to the latter. Why do we need an economic model? In truth, what we are modeling. I'm hearing some ringing in the background. So you're calling somebody now?
No, Dave seemed to have gotten lost. Dave seemed to have gotten dropped off the call.
Okay.
Just trying to get him back on, I guess.
This obfuscation of our promissory obligations each to each other into an instrument which precipitates in terminal failure and ever escalating injustice all the way to that terminal failure, this would be obvious. Not only would it be obvious, if it were obvious, its resolution would be obvious as well, and we would follow that pattern, which we do not, which is the only reason to explain it. I would say just intelligent people capable of self-rule will secure the common vital objects of the people is, indeed, it's obvious, but if that's the case, why is the question asked? You see, what is the proper model? Do we just dispense with the model? Do we dispense with government? Do we dispense with law? Well, we could if we were just people, but being as we are not, we need some way of dealing with aberrations, injustices, crimes against ourselves, which a central banking system is. What is the proper model? The proper model is to sustain whatever kind of trade people desire. And people don't desire to be exploited in their trade. A currency or obfuscation of the currency, which perpetually multiplies artificial indebtedness in proportion to a vital circulation, dedicating ever more of the circulation to servicing ever-escalating sums of artificial debt as opposed to sustaining industry and commerce is obviously not what we desire. So we need a model unless someone can come up with a model. And if we were all doing the thinking that is indispensable to rectifying our affairs in between each other, we would all know what that model is, but we're not. So someone has to suggest it that we have a road to go, a thing to evaluate. In fact, there is only one model which satisfies the common objects of the people. And that being that, whoever consumes of anything, pay for it, commensurable, with their consumption. A true economy obligates us to pay for a home as we consume of it, and that reduces the cost to... That reduces the cost to... just what the costs of production are. So I'm getting all this background noise. Do you want to call Dave for a minute, Randy, and then resume the show?
No, I think we're okay. Dave is...
I'm back. Okay. The bandwidth conditions are less than optimal. I may drop out again. I'm going to try everything I can do to maintain the overall integrity of the show, even if I have to drop off for a while. The show must go on.
Yeah, it's funny. We do our broadcasts have been flawless, except for one or two shows here and there over the last since we came back. Except for these last two shows, this show, discussing a real economic model, and then another show that we did on Monday where we discussed the concept of are cops constitutional. We've been having problems ever since.
Well,
they're out to get us.
No, I don't know.
I think this is more self-inflicted than anything else here.
We've just been having network problems, I think, so.
All right. Well, what is the proper model? As I said, I went home with this idea that of a mathematically perfected economy. Obviously, price inflation wasn't caused by circulatory inflation. obviously circulatory inflation wasn't our only problem. And of course, the first thing we have to recognize is that a currency or medium of exchange is conducive to our purposes because it's universal. In other words, in barter, you might go to a market with a goat and a herding dog, and you want to trade those for whatever. Let's say two cows, and you presume that their value is roughly equivalent to the two cows you envision procuring, but you go to the market and you don't find anybody who has cows that wants your goat and your dog for them. So perhaps you run around until you find somebody who wants your dog and you find somebody who wants your goat, or several people who want your dog and several people who want your goat. And then you run around trying to find other people who have what those people want, which might not be cows, until you finally find a string of people that connects you, people and their desires, which connects to the cows that you want to get for your goat and your dog. Of course, that could be quite a bit of work. It also could be so preclusive that because the person who has one property and wants another has to provide an unbroken chain to what you want, that maybe you can't even pull off such a deal at a given market. Whereas if you have a currency which tokenizes the value of your goat, your dog, and the two cows that you're hoping to procure, all you need to do is sell your goat and your dog for the right price, and you can go over and transfer so many tokens of their value to the person who has the two cows and pull off the deal. So on the one hand, currency has a value as a universal medium of exchange, if and only if it preserves the value. If on the way to the person who has the two cows, the value of your currency decreased by half, you couldn't perform this transaction either. And likewise, if on the way to that same vendor of the two cows, the value of the currency doubled, you might wait a while further and buy 20 cows with it instead. So a universal medium of exchange requires two things, at least. Probably a third. Number one, it can't really cost us anything, because those costs would diminish our ability to trade. In other words, instead of being paid so much for our goat and our dog that could procure two cows, say 10% of that was dedicated to the costs of tokenizing their value, then we wouldn't have enough to purchase the two cows. So zero cost is another value, another advantage, or indispensable object of an economy. And the other thing is, we have to maintain a perpetual one-to-one relationship between tokens of value and the actual remaining value of the thing they represent. And the only way to do that is to eradicate interest and to pay against the principal so much as the depreciation or consumption, rate of consumption of the related product, which is, as I've said, if you have a $100,000 home with a 100-year lifespan, and we issue $100,000 into circulation, paying the true creditor who produced or owned the home in full from the very outset, therefore, we're, our obligation is of any promissory obligation is to pay out of circulation the principal at the rate of consumption or depreciation of the related property. So if we divide the 100-year lifespan into the $100,000 value of this home, then we find that overall the rate of payment is $1,000 a year or $83.33 a month. And people are surprised at the disparity between this and the present system because they never done the math of contemplating, you know, this obfuscation of our promissory obligations, which isn't a debt to the banks at all. So the third is this eradication of interest is necessary also because it multiplies the sum of artificial debt in proportion to a circulation, dedicating ever more of the circulation, therefore, to servicing the ever-escalating sum of debt until we suffer terminal failure. But all along the way, and from the very first, some of the circulation is dedicated to servicing interest, which is what I call maldisposition. Poses the circulation ever more to servicing an artificial escalating sum of debt as opposed to sustaining the commerce that we want. So it's not just necessary to maintain a circulation which at all times is equal to the remaining value of the property it represents or tokenizes. It's likewise incumbent upon us to eradicate interest because interest dedicates ever more of the circulation to servicing the artificial sum of debt, which is this maldisposition. So, in truth, then, mathematically perfected economy is an integral solution of three categoric faults. So when, you know, I went home from school this day, where this idea amounts to a prescription for mathematically perfected economy, an economy without inflation, without deflation, without maldisposition, which all of which together, those three things I conglomerate into a first categoric fault of inflation, deflation, and maldisposition. And the second categoric fault I give is systemic manipulation of the cost or value of money or property. Practically anything could fall into that category. And the third category is this issue of inherent, irreversible, and therefore terminal multiplication of artificial indebtedness by interest. Now, of course, the first categoric fault, inflation, deflation, and maldisposition, is resolved by eradicating interest, which eliminates maldisposition, and the schedule of payment, which retires principal at the rate of consumption or depreciation of the related property. So instead of borrowing money into circulation, what we're actually doing, even in this present live economy, is we're issuing our own promissory obligations. No money comes into circulation unless we assume a debt. The difference is that the banking system, the central banking system, intervenes upon our commerce to say, no. You can't issue your promissory obligations to each other on your own paper. They have to be issued on our paper. And so what's happening, actually, what I call the obfuscation of our currency, is that this intervention comprises basically this situation here. Instead of issuing our $100,000 promissory obligation for this home and paying $1,000 a year or $83.33 a month for it, the banking system says you can't issue it on your you can't contract to pay the real creditor on your paper. So we will issue it on our paper. Our paper is the only good paper. So basically what happens is that across the world, regardless of the currency, it takes about $2 to issue $100,000 into circulation in physical form. So what's really happening in a central banking system is you're not borrowing money from the banking system. The peripheral banks indeed borrow it from the central bank, but the central bank just creates it by assuming this $2 cost of publishing the evidence of our promissory obligation for $100,000. And instead of retiring the payments of principal from circulation, it launders them into its possession. It never gave up lawful consideration comprising an actual debt to the central banking system. It's a sleight of hand. What's going on is they're first laundering the principal into their possession, because the natural life cycle of a promissory obligation, which is paid the true creditor in full, is that the debtor or obligor, as I prefer to call them, pay and retire the principal from circulation. So if the central bank was actually serving us, of course it wouldn't be a private set of private corporations in every country of the world. Instead, it would be a part of government, which merely performs the accounting of retiring the payments of principal from circulation, so that as we pay for the house, as we consume of it, the remaining circulation equals the remaining value of the house. And this perpetual maintenance of that relationship is the only thing that maintains the integrity of the tokens of value to the actual creditor who gave up the house for the promissory notes. So the second crime of the banking system then is even far worse than laundering, than artificially enriching itself to the extent of all the principal that's ever issued and laundered into their possession in this way. And that is, for the mere $2 that it costs to issue the evidence of a $100,000 debt, not to them, but to pay the principal out of circulation. Paid principal is the property of no one. It's null and void. It's evidence of a fulfilled obligation. The circulation is comprised of evidence of unfulfilled obligations. And so the fulfilled obligation no longer belongs in circulation. So this imposition of interest, as if $100,000 had been given up by the central banking system, which it never did. It only assumed the $2 costs of publishing the evidence of the promissory obligations on their paper. And so this huge criminal misunderstanding that we're borrowing money from the banking system, which is wrong. We're merely allowing the purported banking system to pretend to be creditors, when in fact they give up nothing. They're falsified creditors. And we believe thereupon that we are actually borrowing money into circulation, when in fact the money never existed. They create it, but not as a favor to us, instead as a necessary opportunity to impose this obfuscation of the currency on us, which launders all the principal into their possession instead of retiring it from circulation, and multiplies the artificial falsified debt to the banking system into a terminal sum of debt by this imposition of interest, which comprises this implicit obligation to maintain a vital circulation by perpetually borrowing back into circulation the principal and interest we pay out of circulation in servicing even any existent sum of debt. with, of course, then the payments against principal being reborrowed as new principal equal to the old, making it mathematically impossible to pay down the sum of debt, and the interest that we pay out of circulation and borrow back into circulation to maintain a vital circulation, therefore comprising a process of perpetually escalating the sum of artificial indebtedness in proportion to the circulation or remaining capacity to service debt until we suffer the present terminal failure. Now, this isn't just theoretical. It's the whole body of you know, experience that the purported authorities have, and that we, the people, as unwitting subjects of involuntary servitude, experience as well. All of it amounts to a testament to this fact that a sum of artificial indebtedness is perpetually multiplied in proportion to a vital circulation, and thus to you know, into the present terminal failure. Now, truth of the matter is, I provided the Reagan administration in 1979. I provided the Reagan campaign with mathematic proofs that Reagan's proposition of decreasing federal tax rates 10% per year for 3 years, of course, would succeed in eradicating price inflation. Of course, the explanation for that is very simple. Federal taxes are not the they're a sub part of the cost of all things, and if we're suffering an increasing cost of all things in excess of 10% owing to interest, then of course reducing federal taxes 10% per year for 3 years doesn't even account for the sum of price inflation, much less its cause. The other things that I provided to the Reagan campaign were proofs that the economy would inevitably fail, and that there was one and one only solution to that failure, which was I provided in a prescription for immediately converting any purported economy subject to interest into mathematically perfected economy. The basic process of that is to refinance all debts, counting all prior payments of interest instead toward principal, which itself would resolve almost all of the world's present sum of debt, and thereafter paying the remaining principal, if any, at the rate of consumption or depreciation of the property. So this prescription actually has been online for many years. My material has been online since 10 years before the formal internet, because in 1982 I actually had given up on the Reagan administration, and suddenly I got a telephone call explaining that insiders were divided on my propositions, that this person who called me was yet an advocate of this transition to mathematically perfected economy, which I prescribed. I even showed how to do this in a single day, not only immediately, but even virtually without cost. And so this person who called asked me, after extensive discussion, if it was possible to actually calculate the maximum possible lifespan, as I call it, of any purported economy subject to interest. And I answered absolutely, and prescribed exactly how to do so. So it ended up that I produced computer models, which I submitted about 9 months later, which were capable of actually calculating the maximum possible lifespan of any economy, purported economy subject to interest. And with 1983 and four numbers, those models projected from then that this present lie of economy would impose upon itself its own failure at approximately 2010 AD. So, Randy, I guess I'll take that question you have now.
Sorry about that, Mike. Like I said, I'm having to unmute so you can hear because of the background noise I'm having here. But, hey, listen, I've got a couple questions for you, if you don't mind.
Right.
That came from the chat room. One of them. Let's start with the easier one first.
Let's do one at a time.
That's what I'm doing. Let's start with the easiest, with the more simple one first. And that one was, um, With the production of goods, and with the production of goods, that when you were talking about the cost of production, are you also factoring in the profit margins based, you know, the profit margins for the contractor or developer of these items as well?
I'm accounting for it, and mathematically perfected economy accounts for it.
Okay.
The issue is, a free market, a truly free market system, cannot be subject to interest because, of course, the costs of exploitation infringe upon our capacity to pay to producers whatever we determine is a just price. So it's impossible for us to determine a just price under the present systems because they are, in fact, not free market systems. Ever more of whatever we pay for anything is dedicated to servicing the escalating sum of artificial falsified indebtedness to the banking system.
Okay.
So the idea in regard to answering the question is that we determine what the value of anything is. So it's not a matter of whether I factor it in. Whatever you, the people, we the people, determine to pay for anything is what we determine is a just price. So in effect, we decide the value of quote unquote money, under mathematically perfected economy. And in truth, it's impossible for us to decide either the value of money or the value of property in terms of what money we can pay for the property under the present obfuscation, because there's a scarcity of capital or circulation which exists, and this process of inherent and irreversible multiplication of artificial indebtedness, this process is irreversible so long as we succeed in maintaining a vital circulation.
Okay.
And as it dedicates ever more of the circulation to servicing debt, of course, that leaves us ever less that we can spend on the production of industry, or what we call commerce. So the answer to the question is, whatever you determine, it counts for what we call profits, and profit is really not the proper word. The proper word is income.
Okay. Now the next question I have for you came from some. Now here's what he asked: am I missing something? Does Mike assume that any currency issued by government is fiat, as opposed to setting the accounting value of gold and silver? Basically, are you assuming that everything, that all currency is fiat, even if it's based upon gold and silver, or?
Well, this is something, that question is more of an assertion. This proposition of a precious metal monetary standard is inherently flawed because the advocates of it claim that it achieves this one-to-one relationship between the value of money and the value of gold, which ostensibly is consistent. But the problem is, gold is not the only thing that we need to tokenize in order to have a circulation which is sufficient to sustain the industry that we are capable of. So implementation of a precious metal monetary standard always results in an improper circulation, in either deflated circulation or an inflated circulation. And generally, because the world population has grown and industry has grown, it results in a drastically deflated circulation, a circulation which is so minimal that it can't possibly sustain the industry that we intend for it to do so. So this results inevitably in a fractional reserve policy.
Right, okay. Now, as far as that goes, now that kind of that leads into the next question, which was...
Well, I wasn't quite finished with that one. I was pausing because I'm hearing the background noises.
I'm sorry about that. Go ahead. No, I've got family in town, and they're not going to sit here and do nothing while I get while I'm on the air with you. So unfortunately, we got to deal with that.
Right. Yeah.
But
I lost you.
I was saying I'm gonna mute my mic and go ahead and finish so I can get rid of as much of the background noise as possible.
Oh, okay. The issue then is that people blame our problems on a fractional reserve system, and the same people who advocate these partially formed thoughts which aren't accountable to all of the objects, even that they themselves claim, they regularly presume that a fractional reserve system is the cause of our problems, when in fact it's first and foremost a consequence of any precious metal monetary standard, because a finite resource of a given kind or kinds isn't sufficient to issue a circulation which would sustain industry which may grow vastly beyond that circulation. Now, they often dream that a precious metal monetary standard in its extremely restrictive circulation or deflated circulation would simply result in lower prices, and in fact decreasing prices. But this isn't possible under the natural course of industry production and consumption, because commitments exist, contracts exist to deliver and to pay, and former values. These maintain the elevated values of production, and of course, to sustain the industry, which is responsible for the production, requires sustaining the prices, which recoup this. So being as these commitments endure across time, being as they serve as the relative basis for making further commitments, the truth of the matter is, it isn't just, deflation is not, a just consequence or object of any purported economy. It inherently, invalidates any prior one-to-one relationship between a circulation and the property that it tokenizes, the property and commitments that it tokenizes or represents. So this, it just can't work out to resort to a precious metal monetary standard. Another thing to understand about that is that a precious metal monetary standard is actually more or less an intended safeguard for improprieties that, even if they aren't recognized, are nonetheless experienced under any such system. And the reason that this safeguard exists is because, ostensibly because, it affirms to the public that when the money becomes valueless or economy, production and commerce become impossible, that still at least people could get gold for their paper, you know, which in truth is very little promise at all. In truth, it implies that there are underlying fundamental faults that we have to resolve somehow. So, the thing that we have to recognize, if we're ever going to achieve an actual solution, is that there's only one thing which sustains the value of money, and that is if it truly, throughout its life, naturally represents the very thing that it tokenizes, that it's intended to represent. And this, in fact, then, under mathematically perfected economy, makes the value of all represented wealth for whatever we issue a promissory obligation for, free of exploitation, It's sustained throughout the lifespan of every unit of the circulation because of this obligatory eradication of interest and this obligatory schedule of payment that retires principal at the rate of consumption of the related property. So as we pay $1,000 a year, given linear rates of depreciation, which I don't advocate, but for the sake of easy understanding, I use them as in examples. But so long as we understand that's the reason that I'm citing a linear rate of depreciation, then overall, being as we pay $1,000 out of circulation per year, at the end of year one, for example, the remaining value of the house is $99,000, and $99,000 of circulation exists in relation to that, still tokenizing it with a perpetual one-to-one-to-one relationship between the remaining circulation, remaining value of the represented property, and the remaining obligation to pay just that much for the remaining value of the circulation. So, in effect, then, because it's impossible, first of all, to ostensibly provide quote reserves unquote, which effectively tokenize a circulation, which can sustain all industry, because the only way that we can sustain all industry is if the circulation equals the property that it represents. And one way that we can understand this is an example that I can elaborate on, but in which we trade all of our production in one moment across the entire world. The only way that we can do that is if the circulation equals the production. Another thing that's understood from this need to maintain this perpetual value of the circulation in the one-to-one relationship that even the present advocates of returning to a gold standard claim is necessary. They claim that, you know, there's circulatory inflation. And this is one reason that we have to return to a gold standard, so they claim. Well, first of all, as I said, circulatory inflation is impossible if debts are collateralized. In fact, debts are collateralized, although I agree there are means have been developed for circumventing this and artificially inflating assets and wealth, and this is a natural consequence, of course, of the lie of economy, which imposes this ever-escalating sum of indebtedness on us because we're compelled to borrow more and more and more and ever more beyond a true valid extent of collateralization. So in truth, then, under mathematically perfected economy, owing to an eradication of interest and this obligatory schedule of payment, we achieve this object of eradicating inflation, deflation, and maldisposition. And in truth, in effect, at the same time, the actual property is the reserve. It fulfills the unfulfillable concept of reserve in a precious metal standard or any other standard related to finite resources, ostensibly upon which a relatively infinite circulation may necessarily be issued if we are to sustain all the industry and prosperity that we are capable of. So precious metal monetary standard, to review, inevitably precipitates in a fractional reserve system if we try to sustain further industry beyond what that incredibly limited, finite circulation would sustain. And this problem is only resolved by mathematically perfected economy because it makes the actual property that the currency represents the very reserve. And because it does that, it doesn't require any further safeguard because always, 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 at all times, the circulation is redeemable in the very property that it represents.
Yeah, that makes a hell of a lot of sense. I like it.
Now, I've got a couple of questions for you now as far as that goes as well. The other one that I have for you goes back to the concept of usury now. The other part of that question was the only problem. Oh, I'm sorry, let me get back to that other question there. Another problem that this person, or another concern this person has is usury. You said, you know, apparently I think they must be confused because they think that you're talking about reducing interest rates. And what you're talking about is
eliminating interest altogether.
What you're talking about is getting rid of interest altogether to the banks, even including the, or other, even on a promissory note, no interest. You just make it part of the profit. Or income.
Yeah, you're not borrowing money from banks.
Right.
And this word usury, we have to get it straight. Usury, in the original language, which the concepts were expressed to us in, it just meant to, require repayment of a debt. And more or less literally, and more. You know, usury meant and more. Now, it wasn't taught what the ramifications were of this. It was taught that just to require more was, let's say, adverse to our common objects. But this resulted in time, and in my own research, I can determine that interest or usury were deployed in recognizable crimes against humanity as early as 1500 to 2000 BC. Many years ago, in the early 70s, I published an essay, Interest is Usury. What's happened in modern times, coincident to the unassented and unjustified imposition of central banks upon us, is that the word interest was introduced as an ostensibly distinguishable and exempt degree of usury in regard to the teachings, the religious teachings against usury. Now, the thing is that from this very day in this economics class, we can understand, on the contrary, that any rate of interest at all, which is profitable to the purported banking system, because it requires us to borrow interest back into circulation to maintain a vital circulation, therefore multiplies a sum of artificial indebtedness in proportion to a circulation or remaining capacity to service debt until it imposes terminal failure. When I say I produce these computer models for the Reagan administration, for example, those models, the Reagan people asked me if, you know, I could produce such a thing, and I said yes, and basically prescribed how I would go about it and how valid the answers would even be, which it can actually calculate the maximum possible lifespan with incredible accuracy. A probable lifespan typical rates of interest, it can calculate when we suffer a terminal sum of artificial indebtedness within hours, if not days at the worst. The problem is what interest rates to calculate for. You know, if any student of, you know, the lie of economy knows that it's been said for ages that higher rates of interest fought inflation, or price inflation is what they meant to say. And there's a number of preposterous things about this proposition. For one thing, anyone who resolves issues, that is, develops a solution, characteristically works in a very different way. In other words, a usage of one term, inflation, isn't perpetually inherited in the downstream processes of developing an understanding of what's going on, a fundamental cause of injustice, impropriety, failure, whatever is determined, or solution. That is, once we prove that inflation is impossible under where debts are collateralized, once we prove, on the contrary, that price inflation, the only systemic cause of price inflation, is interest, then we have distinguished these things as two separate things. We have what I've called for 40 years circulatory inflation, that is, an increase in the circulation per goods and services. And this is only theoretical. It you know, abiding by this very strictures of the system make actual circulatory inflation impossible. Now, people are probably shaking their heads right now because they've never done the math on this. But here's the problem. You know, Ron Paul, for instance, has advocated that, you know, they're creating money out of thin air, which is a preposterous assertion because that isn't the issue at all. The issue is not that they're creating money out of thin air. In fact, they're not creating money out of thin air. All money is created on our assumption of a promissory obligation. What's going on is we're allowing separate private property parties from the parties who have the right and authority to engage in the contracts they are without exploitation. We have separate parties, a central banking system, which intervene upon their ability to contract for the purpose of exploitation by this obfuscation of the currency. So the question is, do we have circulatory inflation? All, you know, Ron Paul, Dennis Kucinich, and their followers are decrying circulatory inflation, but we're only suffering small fractions of, you know, percentages of increasing circulation, and yet that itself, by definition. Definition is only circulatory inflation if and only if it's an increase in circulation per goods and services, as my teacher had originally given it in the traditional definition. I prefer to say instead per represented wealth. Now, being as we have growth, quote unquote growth, which approximates this circulatory growth, there would be no inflation. Now, these people who keep crying deflation, though, it's the preposterous misunderstanding of a simpleton. And the issue is that you can't just claim that they're pouring all this money into circulation, therefore it results in increase in circulation. Because, and the reason they don't even focus on the ramifications of interest is, you know, Ron Paul boasts that he's an Austrian economist, and Austrian economists are actually, they're not only advocates of interest, they're advocates of elevated rates of interest, as if higher rates of interest would prevent us from borrowing too much. On the contrary, so long as we maintain a vital circulation under high rates of interest, we're actually increasing the escalation of artificial indebtedness at an ever faster rate. And what in the first place ever justified the imposition of interest when, you know, this central banking system or banking system merely intervenes upon our ability to contract issue our own promissory obligations, to assume no more than the costs of publishing evidence of our debts to each other, you know, on the scale of $2 to issue $100,000 into circulation, then obfuscates that into $100,000 debt to itself, which launders the principal $100,000 into their possession for a mere $2 expenditure, and then imposes interest upon that as if that what they had given up duly earned, legitimate, lawful property that they had acquired in a lawful arrangement, which, as we all know, by under contract law in the United States, if the party doesn't give up lawful consideration, you know, there is no lawful contract. There is no debt to the central banking system then, because they never gave up lawful consideration equal to debt. They're only, you know, $100,000 debt. You know, they're only assumed the $2 of cost of publishing evidence of the promissory obligation. So these are the real issues that we're dealing with. And when somebody then just claims for, you know, people were trying to put Ron Paul together with me since the early 1980s, and he's only run because he has no argument against this. If he did, he'd expose it publicly, and we would be laughing at that argument because it would be preposterous. He doesn't even have it. So, when you claim, nonetheless, that we're suffering circulatory inflation just on account of how much money is being lent into circulation, that's only part of the math. First of all, we're paying interest and principal out of circulation at such a stupendous rate owing to this very multiplication of artificial indebtedness that I've just explained, that almost all the money is being paid almost out of circulation almost immediately at all times. And this is the reason so much has to be poured back into circulation, generally by assuming federal debts that we aren't even servicing, because if we were servicing them, we'd be spending even more out of circulation, and phenomenally more, you know, out of circulation. So the whole math is not to just decry how much money is being poured or loaned, quote unquote loan, a better word would be obfuscated into circulation. Instead, it's what's obfuscated into circulation less what interest and principal is paid out of circulation in the same period of time. Now, unless that results in an increase in circulation, and unless that increase in circulation increases in proportion to goods and services, or represented wealth, as I prefer to say, then we have no inflation. No circulatory inflation whatsoever. So it's a preposterous claim by simpletons who haven't even performed the simplest math in regard to this. You know, there's only one model of what's going on here, and it isn't simply how much money is being poured into circulation. It's how much is being poured out. If you've got a lake, and you've got an inlet and you've got an outlet, whatever is coming into the inlet can increase and increase and increase. A river can be in flood stage, it's flowing into the lake. But the level of the lake won't rise so long as the outlet is accommodating it without rise, you see. So, and unless the level of the lake increases in relation to represented wealth, we wouldn't even have the circulatory inflation, which is claimed in this preposterously unaccountable argument, which relates strictly to how much is being poured into circulation.
Oh, it's beyond preposterous. It's pure fraud.
Well, it's certainly such inept thinking as not only can only fail to solve our problems, it can only lead us astray from actual solution. understand that this solution has been around since 1968. I mean, in truth, I went home from one day of school realizing that there was one and one only prescription for mathematically perfected economy. But there was a couple of further issues to resolve to prove that two things, that a promissory obligation is the only legitimate vehicle for monetization. And the reason that it is the only legitimate vehicle for monetization is that every cent, every unit of circulation has to have an obligation to retire it from circulation in relation to the property that it represented and still represents, or we have inflation. You know, people who are advocating spending money into circulation are merely plagiarizing my work. You know, I produced a story, which is the title of it was Parable of Perfect Economy, and you know, and I told it for years before I formally published it in 1979. And, you know, it was even part of the work that I provided Reagan in 1979 and the work that I published to online bulletin boards in, you know, 1983 and 4, 10 years before the formal internet. You know, this entire thesis of mathematically perfected economy, copyright and trademarked, you know, has been publicly available since, you know, 1979 in book form, and since 83 and 4 in electronic form. Complete even with the source code and binaries of the very computer models that I provided the Reagan administration. So we could have done all this a long time ago, and you know, the preposterous thing about the Ron Paul camp is, you know, they're crying end the Fed, end the Fed, and when you speak against Ron Paul, the actual fatal faults of what he's proposed consistently all this while, people presume that you're not for ending, you know, the so-called Fed. You know, people don't realize that, in truth, my work was not the original opposition to the Fed, because there were some people before me who voiced opposition, although they never voiced an actual proof of injustice, inevitable failure, and solution, and even of a prescription for immediately transforming any purported economy into, you know, mathematically perfected economy, not even just immediately, but even virtually without cost. You know, there's a great difference between crying against something as if you're against it and would desire for it to be overturned, you know, and until we realize what a solution is, we don't even have a viable option. But what's really been proposed by, you know, the purported libertarians, who are largely Austrian economists who they claim to advocate free market monetary systems, but what they advocate is not a free market monetary system at all. And the, you know, the belligerent, you know, nature of their, preposterous claims is readily uncovered. For instance, you know, you can go to von Mises, pages. I think it's von Mises, Mises.org or von Mises.org or just Google, Hayek, Hayek, free market monetary system, and you'll come up with the von Mises page that maintains an account of a speech or oral presentation that Friedrich Hayek gave in, I think it was 1975. And in this paper of the, quote, Austrian economists, unquote, And Hayek is one of the purportedly leading Austrians. He doesn't cite any principles or mechanisms as we've, you know, discussed in this interview. Instead, he just makes, obtuse claims that, that we'll never have honest money again. And this is where this word, you know, that Ron Paul always comes up with, honest money, until it's restored to, private banks. Now, the preposterous thing about this is what kind of expert can you be when the money that you're decrying, that you're crying out against, is not issued by federal government, as he's claiming, but instead is issued by the very kinds of private banks that you're advocating, but merely saying that the fact that it's issued by government, which is not a fact at all, it's issued by 12 private corporations, you know, is responsible for destructive consequences we suffer, when in fact it's issued by private banks, and the very consequences we suffer are attributable to its issuance indeed, but this obfuscation of the currency. What's more, why are you crying that this shit is the proper means or disposition of purported privatization? When in fact it's only one private disposition to evaluate amidst at least another alternative, which on the contrary would restore the right of every individual, either individually or collectively, to contract to pay at some future time, which is a promissory obligation. Why are banks ever to issue our promissory obligations when this merely creates a falsified debts to the banks, which give up nothing but the minuscule, negligible cost of pretending to be a publisher, a creditor, when in fact they're actually merely publishing evidence of our promissory obligations to each other? Why would we ever give that up to banks as opposed to retaining it to ourselves? The reason that banks imposed upon it, this obfuscation of the currency upon us, in fact, not just by denying us representation, but actually by usurping representation. You know, the only reason is exploitation. And in fact, since the means is terminal, the only reason is terminal exploitation. No subject society in its right mind would ever think, to submit itself to that. In fact, no intelligent public in history has willingly subjected itself to usury, because it's actually logically impossible to be intelligent and willingly do so, because you're basically saying that the very thing that you're performing when you assume a promissory obligation at a bank is rightly only issued on their paper, though they give up nothing, laundering a debt into their possession, though they gave up nothing, and the obligation is, on the contrary, to retire the principal from circulation, because the real creditor who gave up the property, the $100,000 house with a 100-year lifespan, the real creditor is the former owner of the house, who gives up the property for a promissory obligation. So the interest of both the real creditor and the obligor, as I prefer to call them, is the integrity of the currency. If the current value of the currency went up or down, one or the other of them would be offended. You see? So it's to both of their interests that the value of the currency is maintained. And the only way to do that is through mathematically perfected economy, which necessarily eradicates banking from the equation. Bankers are taking out of it. It's as preposterous to say, okay, we can all create all of this production today. When we say that, we don't even realize that it won't be possible some not too far distant tomorrow to even persist in doing what we're fully capable of doing. And the only reason that we can't persist in that is this imposition of this obfuscation of the currency upon us, which dedicates ever more of the circulation, not to production, but to servicing an artificial sum of indebtedness, which allows those who produce a few who produce nothing to inevitably inherit and unjustly inherit all of our production. You see, and in fact, there's the quote that's prevalent across the internet. It comes from my work, and the reason I can say it comes from my work is that I was notified in the 1970s by academia that Thomas Jefferson never said this. That is, at the University of Virginia in particular, which is the largest storehouse of validated, speech and documents of, which are attributed to, Thomas Jefferson. They say Jefferson never said this, but I'm not a descendant, but I'm a relative of, Thomas McKeon, who was, the second president of the United States under the Articles of Confederation. And, you know, I know that my own family had, you know, or at least claimed to have, substantial, letters between, Thomas McKeon and Thomas Jefferson, who are very close friends, and George Washington as well. They were all three very close friends. In fact, Thomas McKeon was the last person to sign the Declaration of Independence, not because he was disposed against it, but on the contrary, because before it was ready to be signed, he left with General Washington to command troops under Washington in the Revolution. In any case, it's wrong on academia's part, likewise, to claim because they haven't had their fingers on it or whatever, that Jefferson would never have said this. Nonetheless, I concur. I have never found an original source myself other than the oral source that by which I originally acquired this quote. But I know it comes from my work because I found no other work preceding my work which preserved it. That is, I was invited to this engagement. It was a lecture on colonial economy, in which the lecturer didn't understand the principles that he was giving an account of in ways that amounted to definite ramifications, which were important to understand. He was teaching the story as if it was a better thing, but not actually giving any principle by which we could understand why it was the right thing to do as opposed to the wrong thing to do. And in the course of this lecture, he gave this quote, which I preserved, and many people have actually bastardized in order to try and avoid being detected as plagiarists of, you know, my work. But there are literally millions of web pages which preserve this quote in every conceivable adulterated form. The original, many of them even claiming falsely to have sources for it. Even prominent people claiming falsely to have sources for it. But the original quote was, Jefferson was said to have replied to Alexander's final arguments for creating the first central bank in the United States. Jefferson was reported to have replied, quote, "If the American people ever allow the banks to issue their currency. First by inflation and then by deflation, the banks and corporations which will grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children wake homeless on the continent their fathers had conquered. Now, of course, the only reasonable deduction is that by this obscure or ambiguous phraseology, first by inflation and then by deflation, Jefferson is alluding to this very process, which I have outlined, which when the currency is obfuscated into this, these promissory obligations, which are merely published by a banking system, falsifying a debt to the bank, whereas the principal should be retired from circulation, laundering the principal, therefore, into the unwarranted possession of the banking system, and then multiplying the original debt into an inevitably terminal sum of artificial indebtedness by interest. You know, this is the only thing that he could have referred to, however ambiguous the phraseology, because this is the only process, which is intrinsic to the obfuscation of the currency. In fact, in this lecture, I asked this man, his name was Jacques Walker. He was originally from Toronto, Canada. Gave this presentation in Valdez, Alaska in 1975. And I visited with him, and he had vast literary works at his disposal. His pattern was definitely to rely on those works. At the conclusion of his lecture, I asked him if he understood what Jefferson could have meant by that, and he did not, and I explained it to him, and upon my explanation, he invited me to join him at the podium, and the discussion that we had, lasted twice as long as his original lecture did, and everyone was very, very grateful to learn what I taught in regard to this obfuscation of the currency. So nonetheless, I actually don't find any confirmation myself of that Jefferson ever actually said this, and I lost contact with this gentleman from Canada. I was never able to confirm it with him, unfortunately. The possibility that Jefferson said this is very important for us to entertain. And yet at the same time, that men like Jefferson and Lincoln might never even, have existed indispensable to our own understanding of the issues. It may or may not lead to understanding, but it depends, on how accurate and faithful to the facts our interpretation of prior explanation or reference may ever be.
All right, Michael, listen, I've got a question here for you, if you don't mind. This is actually a really good question, I think, and it might actually clear. It's one of the concerns I have as well. I'll just read you the question. I understand and respect Mike's abhorrence to interest, but neglecting the constitutional mandate to regulate the grains of gold and silver to account for availability of gold and silver and increase and decrease of population, coupled with the loose definitions of tokenizing of what is called natural capital, leaves me with questions and warning bells. Our Constitution is quite clear. It calls for a specific currency, and it calls for the regulation of that currency and everything. So how could we get around that and this little thing we come upon with the Constitution?
Well, it is a good question, the currency, which would result of the various possible interpretations of this of the Constitution is I would agree that it's clear, but I would overrule it because it's faulted, and if we attempt to abide by it, we would fail. Let me just give you an example of some of the dispositions of people who might at first be opposed to this proposition of singular solution. One is the gold bugs, which this person, you know, mentions directly or indirectly. Gold bugs typically, you know, advocate honest money, and many of Ron Paul's supporters are gold bugs. But the truth of the matter is, what gold we have, according to, you know, the only purportedly legitimate information, we have, you know, approximately $80 billion of gold in the treasury. Much of the gold that's held in the United States is actually owned by foreign principals. People believe that that they should benefit by holding on to their gold, but there are several improprieties that result of this. Number one, there is artificial competition for ownership of gold, which precludes its usage in industry or our purposes which we would desire to use the gold. If we actually honored this, all gold would have to be used as a storehouse, and yet the result of this would be a very minuscule circulation, which couldn't possibly sustain our industrial activity, much less allow us to even continue servicing but a negligible part of the debts that we've incurred under the obfuscation of the currency. So even if you thought that we could resolve our issues somehow by returning to the gold standard, in no way could we do so. Secondly, that's the last thing that these people who have procured gold as a safeguard desire. They don't want gold to return to the constitutionally defined value of so many dollars per ounce. So, you know, in truth, this is the last thing that they want either. You know, they talk as if they want it in order to discuss anything from the purported standpoint of advocating, quote, honest money, unquote. What is honest money, though? Honest money, the only honest money, is not only immutably tokenizes our production or wealth, it therefore has to comply with this one and one only prescription for mathematically perfected economy, which by merely eradicating interest and this obligatory schedule of payment solve our three categoric faults of one, inflation, deflation, and maldisposition, two, of systemic manipulation of the cost or value of money or property, all of which is undesirable at least to one party, whereas other parties may be benefited, but it's that benefit comes at the cost of justice, and it goes to the few at the expense of the very, very, very many. You see, so, and our third categoric fault that is solved by this eradication of interest and obligatory schedule of payment is, you know, inherent, irreversible, and therefore terminal multiplication of artificial indebtedness by interest. So you can't you know, none of these things can simply be ignored. And yet even these advocates of honest money and their false claims of circulatory inflation and so forth are claiming that, you know, we have to adhere to this, one-to-one relationship between money and represented wealth. Whereas even that isn't enough. That is, solving the traditional definitions of inflation and deflation isn't enough because of this further thing, which I have called for so long, maldisposition. So, and which is solved by eradicating interest. So, no matter how it stacks up, if you want a just money and honest money, the only just money or honest money is mathematically perfected economy because of its immutable tokenization of production in this one-to-one relationship between remaining circulation, remaining value of represented wealth, and remaining obligation to pay just so much as the remaining value of the represented wealth with the remaining circulation. This is the only thing that cements all of those things, all of those objects together. It can't be accomplished by a gold standard. So what the founding fathers did is they erred. Now, and we can understand that, and of course they intended us to perfect a republic. They intended us for us to do this. Now, and that's why we have a constitution, that whatever perfection we accomplish is done in a lawful, organized way. Now, how do we accomplish this is by constitutional amendment. And I've had such a document online for approximately 5 years. It's been subject to public input. All input has been accounted for except where additional desired features rightfully belong in a separate document. But this paper is actually a global mandate for mathematically perfected economy and absolute consensual representation, the title of which is trademarked, Mathematically Perfected Economy and Absolute Consensual Representation. And what this document does is it actually imposes many further restrictions on the process of developing law and the format for expressing law. That is, when a law is developed, it has to clearly state, define its objects. It has to clearly define its means of achieving those objects. It has to clearly define how that process will achieve those objects. And if anyone can disprove that the objects are the ideals which serve us in a common way, that the means will achieve the objects, then even a candidate who proposes such a thing is automatically excluded from an election or is required to immediately amend their proposition and arguments for it accordingly. Should a law exist, it's subject to not only to public affirmation before it exists, but periodic reaffirmation by the public in order to continue to exist. In other words, just the provisions of this mandate for mathematically perfected economy and absolute consensual representation would have precluded ever suffering the Federal Reserve System in the 1912 elections, for instance, after the banking systems who were responsible for the consequences of the banking systems, their obfuscation of the currency, imposed artificial calamities upon us. These artificial consequences, which the present failure is one of, we don't have to suffer this terminal failure, And by terminal, I mean that it is irreversible. In fact, as you view all of the attempts to resuscitate it or recover, all you see is further money poured into circulation, is further debt beyond an already terminal sum of debt, which makes it all the more impossible, in fact, for us to actually recover. The only way that the facade of recovery can even bestowed upon an unwitting people is by completely alleviating any of the obligation to serve this further debt. In fact, you know, since Reagan decreased federal tax rates 10% per year for 3 years in his first, you know, term of office, and then restored them as the failure to accomplish the objects was, you know, blatant. We haven't paid higher tax rates, you know, ever since then. And so in truth, you know, we haven't even sustained ourselves against the further methods of artificially sustaining the system, which accumulate all this further debt beyond our means, since Reagan was in office in his first term, you see. So that's how far away we are from meeting these things. Now, what this mandate for mathematically perfected economy and absolute consensual representation accomplishes in regard to averting the present failure, saving all the homes that are in foreclosure, and immediately making us approximately 12 times as solvent as we are now, is this very thing that I've already expressed in regard to how you repair such a system by transforming it into a mathematically perfected economy. So I've in effect already answered the question. So what they're really asking is that I reiterate that, make it more clear, perhaps. So this mandate establishes mathematically perfected economy. It resolves the purported obfuscated debt to the banking system by issuing, in effect, a like irredeemable promise to pay, leaving it open to the banking system to challenge our legal authority for doing so. Meanwhile, each of us are endowed by merely signing the mandate, which claims a right to sovereign rights as an individual. That is, even as individuals, not as a majority, we are claiming our right to participate in our republic on free of this crime of which has been imposed upon us. The mandate actually is a mathematic proof of it is a crime, a mathematic proof of the obfuscation of the currency, a mathematic proof that the only resolution of this issue is to restore the rights of all people. You see, under a republic and under our constitutional government, likewise, no individual can be endowed with rights or privileges or authorities in a private capacity which exceed the rights or privileges or authorities of any and all other private citizens. So on those grounds alone, if not by interpretation of existing law, a central banking system or usury or this obfuscation of the currency is inherently opposed to the very foremost principles of a republic, which delivers liberty by an inseparable combination of freedom and justice, in which justice prescribes the universal bounds of common law, which proscribe our rights to a limit within which our exercising of rights does not infringe upon the equal rights of others. So this is what a republic is all about, and this is why a constitution is an inseparable instrument of any true a republic, and this is also why a constitution has to be a supreme law of the land, and it's also why an imperfect humanity, a humanity which has not perfected its laws or its monetary system, etc., must provide in a constitution, even, a way to resolve lawfully and in an orderly way resolve the issues which are now incumbent upon us. Now, the framers of the Constitution actually intended to do this, and it's right in the Constitution that, you know, any laws which aren't explicitly reserved to the federal government are reserved to, you know, the states or to the people. And when a government fails to abide by the Constitution, it's incumbent upon the people, therefore. We are the last bastion of freedom. We are the last protection. We are the last protectors. We are the last securers of liberty. And we can only do this if we understand our problems, because if we don't understand that, you know, that interest is, first of all, imposed upon us in an unjustifiable obfuscation of our promissory obligations to each other by entities which intervene upon our commerce strictly for a power to exploit us, and we know it's strictly for that power because they would gladly give it up if it weren't their intention to impose this upon us, and it's the only power that exists in the circulation, you see? So it's the only matter of consideration. Do you or do you not? Ben Bernanke, Timothy Geithner, Alan Greenspan, Paul Volcker, do you intend to exploit us? This is the question, you see? And if not, then they would gladly give in to this proposition of mathematically perfected economy, and you can believe that they've heard about it, you know? I mean, I've even been notified by intelligent people that they possess the very models that I provided, computer models that I provided the Reagan administration. These people have known about the crimes, even if they didn't understand them in the beginning. They know the consequences of them, and they have known them for 40 years. I've provided prescriptions for mathematically perfected economy, proof that we must transform this obfuscation of the currency into mathematically perfected economy or suffer terminal failure, proof of a singular prescription for justly accomplishing that purpose by refinancing all our debts under mathematically perfected economy, counting all prior payments of interest instead to our principal, which instead of having all these 10,000 houses a day going into foreclosure in our country, instead makes them years, on average, years ahead of their payments, you see. By reducing, let's just use our $100,000 home with a 100-year lifespan as an example, that house would cost us about $1,000 a month under the present system in its present implementation, whereas by reducing the cost from $1,000 a month to $1,000 a year, we make ourselves virtually 12 times as liquid by this immediate and virtually costless transformation in a mathematically perfected economy, which I prescribed the only means of doing in 1979, you know. So we could have had a monetary solution all this while. And anyone who believes that, you know, these people actually have an interest, a truthful interest in serving the people is absolutely wrong. There is no justification whatsoever for imposing the present terminal costs on the people when, in fact, even in regard to the federal debt, most of the purported principal is amassed by inability to pay the interest, which then is borrowed as a new debt above the former sum of debt increased so much as the periodic interest, as I've already explained, you see. So most of what you're paying against purported principal is even actually interest. When you go back through all time and resolve the actual federal debt to what it would resolve to be under mathematically perfected economy, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny drop, not in a bucket, but in an Olympic-sized swimming pool, you know, if not many Olympic-sized swimming pools, you know. So this is the only way out of our problems, and this is what this mandate prescribes. In fact, we give government a time limit to accomplish this. They're all guilty of treason for any act against this mandate. And so we claim these rights as sovereign individuals. And the reason we do this is because a majority doesn't have a right to impose a purported majority. And what we have in this country is not a majority that sides with the central banking system by its principles or some ostensible fact that it serves us, which can't be proven because it cannot serve us. It can only destroy us under an inevitable state of terminal failure, which results in complete universal dispossession of all our production to entities which produce nothing and to which no real lawful debt ever even exists. So this mandate accomplishes this on the grounds of, you know, the arguments of sovereign individuals, not even as a majority, although I would expect if we are a just country, of course, a majority will sign this mandate. Our issues are currently that, you know, I wrote about, you know, over a million lines of software code last year to put this site online, and we actually need someone to step up to pay for its hosting, because the numbers are that, you know, we could easily have to sustain taking as many as 10,000 signatures a second, because this is an international mandate. We're saving every country: Greece, Italy, you know, France, England, Ireland, Israel, South America, North America, Australia, you know. So being as the form we need to offer it in is this global form, the simple numbers are that we could easily have to sustain taking 10,000 signatures a second, which require registration of 10,000 2-kilobyte database records per second, which vastly exceeds what's necessary to impose in terms of stress on a server to accomplish what's called a denial of service attack. So we need very expensive hosting to go online. The document and the site are ready to go online now, and our arguments again are this rights that we claim as a sovereign individuals. In fact, we're even claiming as sovereign individuals the right to require anyone who opposes us to pay off their share of the debt, because it's they have no right to impose it upon others, and particularly their own progeny. So that's how these issues are resolved. Over 40 years, I've engineered this fact of one solution, refining its implementation to the facts at hand, which involve considering the fact that, these people in government won't even respond to my appeals to them, because they have no argument against mathematically perfected economy. I mean, we don't have to be advanced mathematicians to understand these issues. Inflation and deflation, for instance, circulatory inflation and deflation, which are defined respectively as increases or decreases in circulation per, I prefer to say, represented wealth. Well, what is the solution for inflation and deflation? I, you know, people used to regularly tell me, you know, there, you can't solve that. There, you know, there wouldn't be any solution. Well, it's, excuse me, it's second grade math to understand that if one problem is defined as an increase in something, whatever that is, per something else, whatever that other thing is, and the other thing is a decrease in the first something per the second something, then the only thing that solves both the first definition or an increase and the decrease is to maintain something which is at all times equal to per the second thing, you see? And so there is obviously one and one only solution to inflation and deflation. Likewise, obviously, there is one and one only solution to maldisposition. And likewise, there is one and one only solution to the third category fault, which I give, which is inherent, irreversible multiplication of artificial indebtedness by interest. That is eradication of interest. And the interesting thing is that in determining whether or not this was an actual solution, I had to resolve, what about everything else? And after contemplating all manner and kind of thing that we can conceive of, I ultimately realized that they had certain characteristics in common. That is, they were a consequence of systemic manipulation of the cost or value of money or property. And in realizing this, thus we had a second category fault, which I usually give as a second category fault, which itself is practically infinite manifestations of just two things, inflation or deflation, or maldisposition. So, being as we've solved maldisposition, inflation, and deflation, and their consequences in this inherent irreversible multiplication of artificial indebtedness, by solving inflation and deflation, by eradicating interest in conjunction with this obligatory schedule of payment, in fact, because those are the only powers for systemic manipulation of the cost or value of money or property, in fact, then, we have solved the second category fault, or systemic manipulation of the cost or value of money or property, by our integral solution of our first and our third categoric faults. So that's why there is one and one only mathematically perfected economy, which, owing to its eradication of interest and obligatory schedule of payment, which are achievements which are intrinsic merely to restoration of the right of the individual, of every individual, to issue their promissory obligations free of exploitation. We have one and one only solution, which in every case, at every moment, resolves inflation and deflation, maldisposition, systemic manipulation of the cost or value of money or property, and inherent, irreversible, and therefore terminal multiplication of artificial indebtedness by interest. And there you have it. So mathematically perfected economy basically amounts in the end, nonetheless, to it's merely the monetary equivalent of barter. It's an accounting system which tokenizes our wealth. It wouldn't even require a physical form of money. It would largely be implemented by what I call a common monetary foundry. Obviously, we don't want to call it a bank if it doesn't concur with the concept of a bank as we purportedly know, quote, banking, unquote, today. So in its duties, I can conceive that a fitting name for it is a common monetary foundry, because it issues the promissory obligations of every individual, either individually or collectively, free of interest, and obligating them to pay for the related property as they consume of it. And so it would largely consist at a minimum of software and data, which implement an accounting system in which creditworthiness is certified whenever anyone wants to monetize production. When I decide that $100,000 is the proper price to pay for a given house, then what happens is if my earnings and other issues resolve out to a fact that I'm very capable of paying $83.33 a month for that home, then the owner is issued the $100,000, and my obligation is to pay the $100,000 out of circulation as that house depreciates in value or as I consume of it, so that we maintain this perpetual one-to-one relationship between the circulation and the remaining value of the home. And it's as simple as that, really.
You know, you brought up two really great points there, Mike. This whole system boils down to monetizing barter and getting rid of usury. Two very basic, two very simple concepts, and which we look back to were almost, I mean, they were basically the foundation of our entire economic system from before. We traded goods and services to each other long before we had gold and silver.
We also attempted to monetize production by a variety of manners. And it's really a curiosity why the Constitution, in fact, does not give us a monetary system. It merely attempts to do something which cannot rightly be done, that is fixing the value of gold or silver in so many units of currency. And there's, you know, the original thinking that existed at the time, you know, was, let's say, prescribed itself by the fact that no monetary solution actually existed before. And the men who authored, you know, the Constitution lived at a time when there was there wasn't really even an attempt to exhaustively define a justifiable monetary system. It was merely presumed that, well, we can only do this, therefore this is the result of it. You know, even today you hear people say, for instance, well, everyone knows that banks have to issue our money. That's not true at all. How can you possibly know that? Well, the founders were faced with a number of difficult things, to resolve. Which in truth can only be resolved by, well, we could take the quote of Jefferson, which I cited, you know, if the American people ever allow the banks to issue their currency first by inflation and then by deflation, the banks and corporations which will grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children wake homeless on the continent their fathers had conquered. Well, we can take that expression, first by inflation and then by deflation, and we can resolve that out into the issue which needs to be resolved. And once we've defined inflation and deflation, well, we can clearly see that there's one and one only solution for inflation and deflation. The expression regards a process, however, of inflation, simultaneous inflation and deflation, which he describes first in the quote, which is not verified to, you know, originate from Jefferson, although it's parallel to many other things he said, you know, of course. But it's a bit more incisive than anything else, perhaps, in terms of resolving economy, but it appears at least to relate to this simultaneous process of inflation and deflation. That is, this obfuscation of the currency is basically it comprises a process of inherent unavoidable deflation of so much as principal and interest out of a circulation which can only be comprised of some remaining principal. Therefore, it comprised a further obligation to borrow back into circulation or reflate the circulation, which isn't properly called inflation then. It's reflation. Reflation is a better term, at least. So that we have, you know, we have so much coming back into circulation as we have inherently going out, and being as this process, this process altogether of deflation and reflation multiplies artificial indebtedness in proportion to the circulation or remaining capacity to service the debt. Of course, we ultimately suffer terminal failure. When you realize all these things, you're obligated to take them the little step further of resolving their only solution, which is a combination of eradication of interest and the obligatory schedule of payment. I mean, it resolves to that simple of a solution. So you're obligated to do that, and yet we don't really have any evidence that they went there, and the result was a compromise which was so flawed that if we were to sustain the further prosperity we would desire to enjoy and would be capable of producing, we would need to expand the circulation beyond the monetary reserves. And after all, if you're just going to tokenize that, what could you expect but this extremely restricted circulation, which wouldn't even be sufficient to convey all circulation. Suppose, for instance, everybody just got afraid all of a sudden and said, oh no, I've got all this paper, give me the gold. I want the gold. So then they hold the gold because they're just sitting out a bad time, which is the inevitable consequence of this multiplication of artificial indebtedness, you know, because this system coexists with banking, which in effect has the power to transfer the value, the ownership of the gold to the bankers if they can get a hold of it. You know, if you hold some of it yourself, okay, big deal, but did you stop the destruction of the system by the system, by the flawed obfuscation of the principles of the system? You know, it isn't even a principle. It's never been justified, and this is something that we have to understand that, you know, we have been denied representation for 100 years, and the fact that we have allowed ourselves to do this have precipitated in the world being subjected to usury, because behind the military, you know, power of the United States and this obfuscation of the currency here, we've imposed this currency upon the vanquished world, not we the people, but this small group of people who, unbeknownst to the unwitting public, have obfuscated our own promissory obligations into this falsified, these falsified debts to them, which they multiply into terminal indebtedness and dispossession. So, we need to wake up. The world needs to wake up. It is waking up. There are countries which intend to adopt mathematically perfected economy. There are movements for this all across the world. They're gaining more and more traction. We have the only irrefutable arguments for a solution. You know, the other propositions are mere 11th hour plagiarists of my work. You know, you can find quotes from me in you know, in the Money Masters video and in all kinds of places. In fact, the people that produce that were all advocates of interest. Who were they to pretend to be money masters? You know, and now they've flipped, you know, 180 degrees to advocating spending money into circulation, which is something which I disproved in my parable of perfect economy. In fact, they take that as the model. This is why Ellen Hodgson Brown, for instance, has been interested in this quote, Pennsylvania currency, unquote. Well, she learned about that from my model, and that wasn't what was done in Pennsylvania. And that model was given in a story which I titled Parable of Perfect Economy, and until Jock Jacaran plagiarized it from the first page of his purported debt virus, you know, I took off the explanations. Nonetheless, that's why all these people are advocating the second case, which I gave in that parable, and that was to spend money into circulation, which I only it was an embedded fault that I put in this parable of perfect economy, in which the words of Mike Montagna are issued through the fictional, purely fictional mouth of Benjamin Franklin. You know, there's literally millions of web pages now which wrongly cite Benjamin Franklin to have argued his case for mathematically perfected economy. And all that comes from is my very own words in a parable of perfect economy, which I authored in 1975, in which the words of Mike Montagna are spoken to the fictional mouth of Benjamin Franklin.
Well, Mike, listen, you've brought up some incredible points here, and in fact, it's kind of funny. We've been having some discussions in the chat room, and a lot of people have. Well, I was in there also discussing some of the Austrian economic ideas with them, and you know, as they correlate with your ideas, and I think we woke up a couple of Austrians in there who really, well, you know, they didn't really understand what they were talking. You know, the entire concept of what the Austrian economic system was and how it correlates with Keynesian almost identically.
Well, there isn't any difference. I mean, you have Ron Paul advocating that competing banks somehow will solve this. And, of course, if we know, he's advocated that that higher rates of interest would have discouraged us from this excessive borrowing, which is not the case. The opposite is the case. So long as we were able to maintain a vital circulation, higher rates of interest would have multiplied the borrowing that we have to do all the further just to maintain a vital circulation, thus escalating the rate of failure. So this is preposterous. But if anyone studies Austrian economics, I mean, look at how flawed this paper is by, you know, this paper that preserves Hayek's speeches. For instance, he assails a government-issued currency as being the cause of our faults, but yet it's privately issued. The very currency he's referring to is privately issued. And he's saying, without even offering us a principle, that restoring it to private issuance, not of the people, but of the bankers, which ensures terminal failure, is somehow going to solve these problems. And of course, he doesn't offer a single plausible principle, much less a plausible principle. But where does this descend from? If you study Austrian economics, which isn't worth spending much time on, but for instance, you know, in answering to the denigrating remarks which are often made by Austrian, so-called Austrian economists, which there is no such thing as an Austrian economist. The word economy relates to a system which can only multiply cost, artificial and entirely redundant cost upon us until we suffer terminal extents of redundant cost. So, you know, but this idea of interest, it, you know, if you trace it back to the origins of, you know, this purportedly separate discipline of a pseudoscience, what do you find? You find in the work of Baum Bewerk, for instance, which is the earliest that I found any Austrians, later 1800s. But it's the earliest that I found that any Austrian economist attempts to justify interest. And he spends like 4, 5, 6 chapters of a book, opening chapters of the book, because it's the most important issue. And what does he spend those 4, 5, 6 chapters of? Entire chapters. What does he spend them at? He spends them building a case for interest, which amounts to this. The only reason that he attributes any public sentiment against interest whatsoever is merely attributable to religious sentimentality. He refuses any mathematic analysis of the inherent ramifications of the very obfuscation of the currency which put Christ on the cross because he denounced money changers in the temple of the money changers.
Basically, though, I've got to take off, so we've got to cut the show here in a couple of minutes. I got to get the father-in-law on his way back home, So if you could do me a favor, there was a couple of people in the chat room who just didn't quite seem to get it. Now, if you could do me a favor and break down your basic idea, or if you could actually let me allow, if you would allow me the chance to basically break it down into a basic concept that maybe even, like you said, second grade math people could understand.
Well, why don't you take whatever you've got for it? You say 7 minutes in the text here, but why don't you say spend half that given your summary, and I'll correct you on the fine points, if any, as may be. We're doing this because it's compulsive. It's an obligation to do this if we're going to avert not just terminal failure, but the ever-escalating injustice of which by this, owing to this perpetual multiplication of artificial indebtedness, dispossesses us of our own earnings to an ever greater degree and eventually terminal degree.
Now, something else that I've noticed also, and I had asked Murray Rothbard about this. Now, here's what I see from any system that bears interest. Eventually, if we go with more of the Keynesian models where we have really high interest rates, Carternomics, if you will. Interest rates 19%. All that did was keep a few people.
Call that Volckernomics.
Volckernomics. Even better.
Remember, Hayek was wrong.
Hayek was wrong.
The federal government doesn't set interest rates. The Federal Reserve does, which is a misnomer because the Federal Reserve was called the Federal Reserve purposely as a deception of the people, as if it was part of government, when in fact it's 12 private corporations. So the Federal Reserve sets interest rates. We know that. So it's Volckernomics.
But basically, whether you're dealing with Keynesian economics or the Austrian economics, anytime you have an interest-based system, the interest is going to end up imploding on itself. It's going to happen sooner with Austrians because the interest is lower. Higher, because the interest rates are higher, so it'll implode even faster with the Keynesian.
Which is what Volcker was doing as well. So Volcker's elevated interest rates. He was maintaining double-digit prime rates, into the Reagan administration, and those rates were multiplying debt at an extremely escalated rate, And what happens is the greater the sum of artificial debt indebtedness gets, the lower interest rates have to be made in order that we can just barely tread water underneath the further accumulation of debt at the lower rates. And eventually the rates have to be decreased to near zero, but this is of little help because the sum of artificial indebtedness is multiplied to such monumental extents that is still capable of terminating us if we weren't pouring money into circulation as we are in order to reflate the circulation of what interest and principal we're paying out under those monumental sums of debt.
Well, Mike, I think that pretty much wraps it up in a nutshell there. Listen, I've really enjoyed having you on tonight. I'm going to bring you back on again. I've enjoyed our conversations as well privately, so.
Yeah, we've had some better personal discussion.
we've got for several hours, a few nights, in fact. So, listen, next time we come on, I would really like to get more involved with a discussion with you, going over the fine points of your ideas. And how we can implement them today and how it would actually look, how it would benefit Americans and everybody else across the world, and how we could still maintain our independence or our sovereignty, if you will.
Actually, we can only maintain our independence and sovereignty under mathematically perfected economy. We have no independence under this system.
Exactly. So, everybody, I want to thank you for listening in tonight. Mike, I especially want to thank you for coming on tonight.
Well, I much enjoyed it as well, and I thank you. It's the people like you who understand the issue and who will make the most change because by, giving me an opportunity to speak here, and I've been interviewed by several other radio stations a week, and I have my own show, of course, on TNS Radio. So the word is getting out around the world, and the days of the purported economists and bankers are numbered, and growing numbers of people across the world are realizing it.
All right, well, everybody, thank you for listening in. This has been another edition of You Have Trouble Me Radio. And next week we're going to be having, actually, you know what, to be honest with you, I don't know what we're doing next week. I've got guests coming on, but I've been busy with my...
You might have to do me again, Randy.
We might have to do you again. So we'll definitely get you back on here the next couple of weeks, Mike. You had mentioned TNS Radio. You have a show every Sunday, correct? Or every Saturday, I'm sorry.
Every Saturday, 2 o'clock Pacific time. It's usually a three-hour show, but I have an open slot. Sometimes the show goes 7 hours. It's you can listen live from TNSradio.com, which TNS stands for Tir na Sar, Land of the Free. It's broadcast from Ireland. Ireland is one of those countries where there's a growing movement to adopt mathematically perfected economy immediately. So my show archives can be found by going to tnsradio.com and looking on the right hand side of the page. There's a category, Mike Montagne, Montagne, and the first 8 programs are teach all these principles exhaustively. In fact, the first program would be enough for the very skilled listener who's very disciplined in interpretations. But the first 8 programs should be listened to in order because they explain all the issues and the implementations and so on and so forth. And then I go on and, further programs, dissect word for word, phrase for phrase, sentence by sentence, the lies of Ben Bernanke and so on and so forth. So the archives at TNS Radio for my program are very, very heavily downloaded, and they're traveling all over the world. And they're defeating every contending proposition.
You know, I would agree with you. I've listened to, and I would recommend that as well. If anybody goes, when you go and you download Mike's archives, you have to start at the beginning one and follow them through. The first 8 or 9, go in through all of the ideas, the theories, or actually not even theories, but proven concepts of it, as well as the implementation of it. So it's a step-by-step process that he goes through with the first, I think, 9 or 10
audios. Eight
audios, okay. So, Mike, thank you so much for coming on. Everybody, you guys be safe, you guys be free, and I'll see you this Sunday. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Randy.
Oh, also, perfecteconomy.com is Mike's website, perfecteconomy.com. If you're interested, if you want more information, if you'd like to try and do like I did, try and debunk his ideas, I would jump on there and start looking through everything. I worked on it for almost 20 hours trying to debunk his ideas. I couldn't do it, so...
We can even do it on air.
We'll try and debunk it on air. I'll play devil's advocate. We'll try and debunk it on air.
real quick, Randy, the next show we've got up is the Tar and Feather on the 10th on Sunday with Gary about the courts that we were talking about.
Oh, yes.
That's the next show up. I wanted to go ahead and throw that out there for anybody that's still listening or picking this up on archive.
This Sunday is going to be a Tar and Feather episode, part 3. We're going to be talking about the Committee of Safety Common Law Court that is getting ready to go up and running. So, come in and listen to that one. Mike, you take care. Everybody else out there, be safe, be free. Bye-bye.